could respond to Kirby's response and then overall the Biden administration's position on this and, in fact, on the ICC, which you referred to earlier?
Well, Biden seems to have an endlessly movable red line. And he, you know, rightly at the rhetorical level, keeps pushing the Israeli government to allow in food and other humanitarian supplies, to take greater care not to harm Israeli civilians. It's all the right thing to say. He never backs it up. The only consequence he's imposed so far has been he did stop delivery of these huge 2,000-pound bombs that Israel was using to decimate entire neighborhoods. And he didn't want that to happen in Rafah. So that's to his credit. But then he turned around and authorized $1 billion in additional arms sales to Israel. So that really kind of undercut the message there. They've been saying, you know, we don't want this Rafah operation to harm civilians. But Israel has now chased 1 million out of the 1.4 million Palestinians sheltering in Rafah out of the city. And most of them are, you know, trying to survive on this beachfront camp with no food, no sanitation facilities, no medical aid, nothing. You know, and that was it was near that area that this latest bomb that killed 45 people took place. But, you know, the International Court of Justice last week said these are horrendous conditions. You know, this is not a safe response to this Rafah military operation. But Biden's closing his eyes to that and says we haven't seen any real problems yet. You know, it's proceeding. So the red line keeps moving.
And what do you think, finally, Ken, what do you think is going to come out of this investigation, the Guardian and 972 investigation and revelations about what Israel did to subvert the work of the ICC?
Well, it'll be interesting to see whether Karim Khan does, in fact, use Article 70 of the Rome Statute to prosecute, you know, in essence, obstruction of justice. You know, the sense I got from his statement a week and a half ago was that he was not going to apply that retroactively, but if anything like this happens again, he would use it. I think the most significant effect will be that, you know, Israel is going to try to defend itself using this principle of complementarity, saying we're investigating ourselves. And I think the real effect of this investigation is to really undermine the credibility of any self-investigation claim.
Kenneth Roth, we want to thank you for being with us, visiting professor at the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs, served for nearly three decades as executive director of Human Rights Watch. We'll link to your piece in The Guardian. It's headlined, "The ICC Spying Revelations Show the Israeli Government to be a Lawless Regime." Next up, the largest university in Canada files a request for police to clear a pro-Palestinian encampment. We'll speak with one of the professors there and a Palestinian student from Gaza who's part of the student negotiating team. Stay with us.
Bismillah, like the feeling when I miss Falah, then wish the God and clouds to lift us all. Alhamdulillah, I wonder if BB can ever see me, and if I go back to Basra, will it ever receive me? Bismillah, homies that have the time to talk, now I wish for stars that angels find a walk. Alhamdulillah, I stand ordered the strength of my sister, kiss her and thank God, our mission is planned for. Bismillah, mamati, inti hayati, mom the best one, hold her close to heart like my left. Alhamdulillah, put the truth in the beat. Being as beaming as the moon queen, you bless my future to be with. Bismillah, for the soul's anguish, love, and the moment my brothers program these.
Alhamdulillah, by Iraqi Canadian rapper Narsi and Palestinian British rapper Shadia Mansour. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We go now to Canada, where a judge yesterday responded to an injunction filed by the University of Toronto for the police to clear a pro-Palestinian encampment on its downtown campus. The judge set the injunction hearing dates for June 19th and 20th. In the court filing, the judge acknowledged that those dates do not accommodate the university's interest in clearing the encampment before graduation ceremonies begin in early June, but he said a fair opportunity must be given to the protesters to make their case. Students launched the encampment, known known as the People's Circle for Palestine on May 2nd. It quickly became one of the largest encampments in North America with 175 tents, hundreds of campers, and a sacred fire led by indigenous elders. The camp is supported by faculty, university staff, alumni, and others.
Last week, the university issued a trespass notice to protesters, threatening disciplinary measures for students and staff supporting the camp, threatening an unprecedented mass termination of faculty. On Tuesday, dozens of faculty members held a news conference to speak out against the university's request for the police to clear the encampment.
We say to our administration, if you decide to move against the students, you'll have to go through us first.
That was Deb Cowan, a professor of geography and planning at the University of Toronto. She joins us now from Toronto. She's also a steering committee member of the Jewish Faculty Network. And we're joined by Mohamed Yassin, a graduating senior at the University of Toronto, studying economics and statistics. He's a media spokesperson for Occupy University of Toronto and a member of the student negotiating team. Yassin is a Palestinian with family members currently in Gaza. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! We're seeing a replay of what's happening in the United States and Canada. You have these professors bringing police onto college campuses as they're being hauled before in the United States. It's Congress. In Canada, the president of the University of Toronto, just spoke, Professor Deb Cowan, before the Canadian Parliament. You said that the police have to go through you, the faculty, before getting the students in the encampment. Mohamed Yassin, can you start off by talking about what are your demands?
Yeah. First off, thank you for having us. Our demands are very clear and they're very simple. Our first demand is for the University of Toronto to disclose all investments held in endowments, short-term working capital assets, and other financial holdings. The second demand that we have is for them to divest their endowment capital assets and other financial holdings from all direct and indirect investments that sustain Israeli apartheid, occupation, and illegal settlements of Palestine. Our third demand is for the University of Toronto to terminate all partnerships with Israeli academic institutions that operate in settlements in occupied Palestinian territories or support or sustain the apartheid policies of the State of Israel and its ongoing genocide in Gaza.
And Deb, could you talk about the level of faculty support at the University of Toronto, how you became involved with this and how you've been working with students?
Oh, for sure. And thank you so much for having me. It's a true honor to be here with one of the brilliant students, Mohamed, here, and also as a very small part of what is a groundswell, a massive groundswell of support on our campus and well beyond. In addition to the hundreds of faculty that have been actively supporting the People's Circle for Palestine, their staff, there are alumni, there are honorary doctorands who have been stepping forward. And the quote that you shared with me about standing with faculty in front of to protect the students from any kind of police raid of the camp actually was an echo of something that was said the day before in an extraordinary labor rally by Laura Walton, who's the president of the Ontario Federation of Labor, which represents a million workers and 45 unions. And she said, if you move against the students, you'll have to go through workers first. So on Tuesday at the faculty rally, we echoed that same commitment to defend and protect our students in their very righteous, courageous stand.
And Mohamed, could you describe the encampment, how the tents were set up, how all of the students organized, and what prompted the organization of the students at this time? To what extent were you inspired by what began at Columbia University right here in New York?
Yeah, so with regards to, what inspired us to do this, obviously we did take heavy inspiration from our fellows at Columbia. But organizing at the University of Toronto, at least from our student, segment, has been going on for at least 7 months, at least in our capacity. We've had our demands sent to the university and the president directly, who continue to ignore us for about 6 months. until we had similar actions, including the occupation of the president's office for about 36 hours. This encampment is simply an escalation on that, as the university has refused to meet with Palestinian students and meet our demands, you know, even more simply than that. With regards to the encampment itself, it was a night in which a lot of people came together. And at about 4 in the morning, we entered King's College Circle, as it was called, now the People's Circle for Palestine, which was fenced off by the university in anticipation of something like this. When things started, you know, happening in Colombia, the University of Toronto set up a fence around the circle, expecting us to take that area, knowing that it's the heart of the university, right in front of the building in which the administration meets, in which, you know, President Mayor Gertler has his office. And as such, they tried to prevent us from taking that space. As students, we, you know, have all the right to be there. It's our university, it's our space. And so at early morning on, you know, May 2nd, 4 in the morning, we entered that space anyways and set up all of our tents.
And Professor Deb Cohen, if you could explain, how is the Faculty Association at U of T responding to faculty such as yourself who have shown solidarity with the encampments? What is the level of faculty support, and how has the administration responded so far to faculty who have supported the encampments, the pro-Palestine encampments?
Yeah, like Mohammed here, I would want to say that the faculty support has been longstanding, and certainly faculty organizing around Palestinian liberation has taken place for many, many years on the University of Toronto campus. In fact, I think one of the reasons why we've seen such strong and such united faculty support for the student-led movement is because of many years of relationship building, of collaboration between a series of networks, including the Jewish Faculty Network, a Healthcare Alliance for Palestine, and the Faculty for Palestine group itself. And even before that, so those groups have been working together for many years. We had a major censure of our campus just a few years ago for the unhiring of Valentina Azarova at the law faculty because of her work on the occupied territories. And even well before that, the University of Toronto campus is known for having been the place where Israeli Apartheid Week was first founded, and where BDS campaigns were led by graduate students, you know, decades ago. So I think there's a long tradition of relationship building, of trust building, and of, I think, very powerful solidarity between students, staff, librarians, faculty, and wider community members. And I can say the Faculty Association responded to preemptive threats from the administration, accusing any potential student encampment of being unauthorized, of being an act of trespass, and also of, you know, the Faculty Association wrote a letter also suggesting that the kinds of the language of the kind of threat and unsafety was also deeply racialized language, which is not insignificant given that the student movement is led primarily by students of color, and in particular Palestinian, Arab, Black, Muslim, and Indigenous students, and of course many, many Jewish students, all groups that have either been that have been historically or ongoing in terms of the racialized stigmatization. So the Faculty Association challenged the whole university framing of the illegality and unauthorized nature of the protest. And that legal letter that was sent to the administration over a month ago now has never actually received response.
Mohammed, before we end, I want to ask how your family is in Gaza right now and what your plans are to the end. I mean, it looks like the injunction is there's going to be a court hearing right around graduation in a few weeks.
Yeah, with regards to my family in Gaza, I'm in communication with them whenever, you know, they get the chance to talk. Obviously, they're not in a situation where they can constantly respond to us. We do get mail from them. They're watching our encampment very closely, actually. They send us letters that are, you know, heartbreaking. You know, anytime I read them, I quite literally can't stop crying. The sentiment is shared by everybody in the camp who I read these letters to. But, it's because of that we have faith in what we're doing. We know what we're doing is just, and all of us are willing to stand our ground no matter what happened. Everybody went into this expecting that a police response is a possibility. Our fellows in other universities up in Alberta were brutalized by the police when they had their stands at their encampments. We're ready to face the same, because what we understand is that anything that we go through is not even a fraction of what our brothers and sisters in Gaza are going through. You know, my family in particular, you know, they've had to eat leaves and grass because they have no food to eat. You know, they've had to, you know, wake up every single day under bombardment. Children are terrified constantly. You know, they've lost all of their innocence. They can't even, you know, live normally day to day. Yet we're expected to sit here and just watch. You know, we can't do that. And as students and as, you know, as faculty, I'm sure, and, you know, as labor workers who have come together for this, we all understand that we have a duty to these people. We have power in our hands. We are put here in a specific position, in this specific time and place, where we can exercise some sort of ability to make a change. And we are all more than committed to do that, no matter the consequences.
And finally, Professor Cowan, when the Canadian Parliament holds hearings on anti-Semitism, if you can respond as a member of the Jewish Faculty Network.
I mean, I think those hearings have been widely dismissed as quite the sham compared to having fossil fuel hearings entirely staffed by, or entirely constituted by pro-fossil fuel or pro-oil companies. I mean, there's not a single member or group represented that diverges from a pro-Israel, a strong pro-Israel lobby. And many groups are even boycotting those hearings. And I'd like to just bring it back to what the camp has been doing, which is, in some senses, it's even baffling that we have to have this conversation, that we're facing these threats of discipline and even termination for tenured faculty, and certainly various kinds of discipline for students. Because from my perspective, and I think from the perspective of many faculty who have been teaching at the university for years and years, we have maybe never seen our campus be so alive with the spirit of debate, of creative thought, of rigorous conversation and dialogue and debate. It is, for me, one of the most precious learning spaces I've ever experienced. And that's in the context. Our president likes to keep saying that, you know, convocation must happen, our graduation ceremonies must happen, because this is the COVID generation and they need those kinds of spaces. Well, it's the COVID generation that has built this camp. And they have built a space of multi-faith collaboration. We've had Shabbat. We're planning our fifth Shabbat for Friday night, where we have prayers in both Arabic and Hebrew. We have these incredible spaces of conversation, of learning, and the learning goes all directions. It's not one direction. So the very promises of our university, which were, of course, compromised deeply during lockdowns, and I think what the university almost seems to prefer, the disconnected, heavily managed student body, as opposed to what is really a manifestation, a kind of emboldening of our institution's statement of institutional purpose that is happening at the Circle for Palestine, the People's Circle for Palestine. So many of us not only defend the basic rights of our students in their stand, in their protest, and in their rights to freedom of speech and assembly, but we feel incredibly protective of the beautiful, beautiful experiment in relationships, in learning, and in a future that is very, very different from what the world is giving us. And we feel a personal stake in defending that space.
Deb Cowan, I want to thank you for being with us, Professor of Geography and Planning at University of Toronto and Steering Committee member of the Jewish Faculty Network, and Mohammed Yassin, graduating senior at the University of Toronto, studying economics and statistics, media spokesperson for Occupy University of Toronto, member of the student negotiating team. Yassin is Palestinian with family members currently in Gaza. Coming up, how 3M discovered, then concealed the dangers of forever chemicals. Stay with us. Back in 20 seconds.
Off the suburbs, and gold is too much trouble to be found. The real thing makes me nervous. Imitate, so there's always more than one. Plastic, plastic, plastic is forever.
Plastic is forever by Sam Phillips. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We look now at so-called forever chemicals used in everything from nonstick pans to food packaging. They accumulate in the human body and environment and have been found in the blood of almost every person in the United States. They are also toxic and have been linked to serious health effects. The danger of forever chemicals, commonly called PFAS, has been known for decades, but it wasn't until just last month that the Environmental Protection Agency set a drinking water standard to reduce exposure in tap water.
Now a new report tells the story of a scientist who worked for the manufacturer 3M, which uses PFAS in many of its products like Scotch Guard and Teflon. For more, we're joined by ProPublica's Sharon Lerner. Her new joint report with The New Yorker is headlined, How 3M Discovered and Concealed the Dangers of Forever Chemicals. The company found its own toxic compounds in human blood and kept selling them. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Sharon. I mean, this is just an amazing story that almost everyone on Earth has these toxic chemicals in them. Can you tell us the story of the former 3M chemist, Chris Hansen, and what you discovered through your conversations with her, though you've been covering this issue for a decade?
Yes. Thank you for having me on. I have been covering this issue for quite some time, since 2015. And so I was aware that 3M, some scientists at 3M had been aware that PFAS, which is one of these classes, the larger class is called PFAS, or forever chemicals. Basically, a scientist at 3M in the 70s had learned that PFAS was in the blood of the general public. And I knew that. And some others knew that from court documents that came out a few years ago. And I had written about that a while back. What this piece does is kind of dig into how this giant company had kept this secret for decades. And it's something I'd wondered about for, you know, since I began reporting on this. How do you keep something like that, you know, away from the public? And I had tried to speak with people inside the company and to, you know, with no luck for many years. And then a scientist named Chris Hansen reached out to me and told me that she had been working in the environmental lab in the 1990s at 3M and that she had been tasked. She had been asked to look at blood samples from the general public and see what was in it, and she had discovered PFAS. And of course, in telling me this story, I realized, wait a minute, of course, it all became clear that 3M had kept this information from its scientists as well. And so she told me the story of discovering this, bringing her findings to her bosses and being essentially gaslit, being told, you know, you must be wrong and your science, you know, it seems flawed and there are problems with the machinery and that kind of thing. And then she eventually discovers that the company had known earlier. And so in writing this story, you know, she brought to me a lot about the inner workings of 3M. And then I kind of was able to take her story and go a little bit further. When she came to me, she hadn't been aware who at the company knew about this, if anyone, you know, the people she was working with. And I was able to determine that her direct bosses had been aware of, you know, the presence of this chemical in blood, even though they had assigned her this task and then appeared to act surprised when she brought her findings to them.
And Sharon, could you explain what are the products that 3M uses that are so widely purchased and used? And what are the other companies? There are a number. 3M is not by any means the only one, the leading companies in the U.S. using PFAS.
Right. So PFAS is a class of compounds. 3M was sort of the led the way. They created PFOS and PFOA, another compound that was widely used. Both PFOS and PFOA are no longer produced. But the compound, the class contains like thousands of compounds that are made now by many companies. 3M has pledged to stop making the entire class of chemicals by the end of 2025. When they made this announcement in 2022, they acknowledged having more than 16,000 products that contain them. So, and that's just at one company, 3M. So folks from the industry have told me they're in every car, in every cell phone. They're in pretty much any product you can think of. Famously, we think of them as coating pans like Teflon, which was produced by DuPont. But they're really just in they're a bit ubiquitous. And so for 3M, the big products were Scotchgard, which is a fabric coating. In the early years, they also used it in food packaging and also in a firefighting foam that became incredibly widely used both by the U.S. military, militaries around the world, and airports.
And, I mean, the story you tell of Chris Hansen, the scientist, being told to compare the blood of workers at 3M, which were clearly contaminated, and then just, you know, compare it to the larger population. They didn't expect, she thought, to find this, where everything she tested in the larger population was contaminated, all the blood. And so the higher-ups at 3M said to her, her equipment must be contaminated, or she must have done it wrong, when in fact, and this is the key point, Sharon, as we begin to wrap up, they knew all along that what she found was true. Can you talk about that?
Yes, that's exactly right. They knew all along that what she was finding was true. And strangely, as he said, she found it everywhere. So it was in animals, although she tested a number of different kinds of animals, and in all the people from all the blood banks around the country she tested. Eventually, she began to test historical samples. And it was only in doing that that she was able to prove that all these positive tests for PFOS were really positive, because, you know, she was able to find blood that had been samples that had been taken before 3M products were on the market. And that was really the way that she was able to find proof that, you know, the positive samples, that they really did contain the chemical.
And the problem with these chemicals, what they cause, Sharon, we just have less than a minute.
Well, they're linked to many, many different health outcomes. The EPA in their regulation on drinking water standards just said that they are likely to cause cancer, that no level is safe, but they're linked to all sorts of outcomes, including developmental, increased levels of risk for all sorts of thyroid diseases, liver outcomes, immune suppression. It's really wide-ranging.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us and really encourage people to read your pieces in The New Yorker and ProPublica. Sharon Lerner, investigative journalist who covers health and the environment for ProPublica. Her new joint report with The New Yorker is how 3M discovered, then concealed the dangers of forever chemicals. The company found its own toxic compounds in human blood and kept selling them. That does it for our show. And a very special congratulations to our senior video producer, Sam Alkoff, on his wedding yesterday to his long time partner, Anna Gold. Oh, and congrats to their children, Arthur and Nina. That does it for our program. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, with Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Shrufa Bokaduz, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, Ravi Karan, Hani Masood, Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prue, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, Anna Osbeck, Emily Anderson, and Buffy St. Marie Hernandez. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
If you're a Canadian Indigenous student considering many life choices about your future, Inspire can help. If you need ideas about possible education options specifically for First Nations, Métis, and Inuit folks like you, join Inspire's mentorship program, Rivers to Success. It's free to register, and you'll get plenty of up-to-the-minute information about Univ College and vocational trade schools. Most importantly, again, it's free. It's free, it's free, it's free. It's online, and we have monthly events with prizes. Discover the many potential job and study opportunities that are waiting for you across Turtle Island. Register online now at rivers2success.ca. Again, that's rivers2success.ca.